Even for investors, right? As if you'd be experienced with this, but like homeowners, like with the ones that are looking, even sometimes we get couples that don't have kids. They've got no plans for kids, but they consider in the future maybe there'll be some resale or renting it out if they leave Japan. So being close to elementary schools is really, really, useful. Close to shops, close to schools, close to parks.
That's always in Japan, right?
Well, I mean, that's in every country.
For family-sized
Yeah.
properties, if you're talking studios or one bedrooms, not so much.
Yeah. But usually when people are buying for their own, their own family home, like in my case, or, again, a couple with no kids, or if they do have kids, being close to the school is always a good selling point. Even if they're not going to use that school in the future, any other typical Japanese family would
Yeah.
likely go to the local elementary school.
Hi there, folks, and welcome or welcome back to Nippon Trading International's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima again, and this podcast is brought to you, among others, by Emil Gorgis of realestate.jp. He's a Tokyo real estate agent who specializes in serving international or mixed nationality families who are looking for the perfect family home. So Emil's an Australian. He's been living here in Japan for over 2 decades now. And for about half of that time, he's been buying, selling, and managing real estate properties in Tokyo on behalf of his own family and a great many happy clients. And he also acts as a mortgage broker on behalf of his clients. So he's got dedicated loan officers in many of the Japanese mega banks. And if you're a regular listener of the podcast, you probably already know him from our JREP, the Japan Real Estate Experts panel sessions, which means that you're already aware of the fact that the man is an absolute fountain of wisdom on all things related to real estate in Japan, and in particular to family homes, the greater Tokyo metropolitan area, and mortgages. And most importantly, he's incredibly generous with his time and advice, which he's more than happy to provide at no cost or commitment to anyone asking. So if you've been thinking about buying your home in Tokyo, but you've been sitting on the fence for a while, or you just want to have a chat in English with a real expert, drop him a line on sales@realestate.jp. Hit him up today and start exploring your options. All right, folks, this is the final call for this weekend's Japan Real Estate Summit. We still have some in-person tickets left, and the Zoom streaming channel allows up to 100 participants, so those are still available as well. If you're still on the fence, just to remind you, advance tickets only for this event. We won't be able to take walk-ins, unfortunately. Streaming tickets specifically are only available until noon, Japan time this Friday, 11th April. You've already heard more than enough about the spectacular line of speakers we've got this time around. And if not, you can check them all out on summit.realestate.jp or in previous episodes. Also, we've confirmed our gala dinner venue. In case you haven't been informed yet, it is none other than Andy's Shin Hinomoto, who, to anyone not familiar with the place, is the one and only British-run izakaya with a huge variety of signature foods, including vegetarian dishes, of course, and a super atmosphere. The place is a bit of a mecca for Tokyo foodies. Andy himself, who owns and has been running the place for the last 25 years, will be hosting us. Drinks will, of course, be served in generous proportions along with the food, and we look forward to continuing our conversations with you and getting to know you better. So gala dinner tickets are separate to the event tickets. We do need to let Andy know how many of us will be attending, so make sure to secure yours as soon as possible at the same address, that's summit.realestate.jp. Only 4 days to go as of this recording. Getting very excited to see you all very, very soon. So for today's episode, which, by the way, was the first one we recorded in 2025, just to give you an idea of the backlog in publishing them, this is a JREP session with Blanca, Emil, and myself, and we had a bit of an informal chat, as always in these sessions, on the topic of education in Japan, middle school, high school entrance exams, the after-school study center industry here, how school choices affect university entry for students down the track, and how crucial academic diplomas from various unis are in Japan compared with other countries. And then we segue into the real estate angle, of course, and we chat about choosing where to live based on schools and how prevalent that is in Japan and in other countries, student housing for kids as young as middle or high school ages, and what exactly is considered to be a reasonable commuting distance here in Japan. When, if ever, does it make sense to
target investment properties near schools and university campuses, which then also led us to a conversation about various tenant profiles, how a building's curb appeal may factor into their choice of which property to rent, and also more generally about tenants, or buyers for that matter, who are at higher income levels, how do they make decisions? And that led us to talk a little bit about money in general, the mentality of high net worth individuals and clients when it comes to spending money, and the importance of financial literacy for anyone, including and especially crucial for children, how we work with clients who are on a tighter budget, and what happens when spouses, particularly mixed nationality couples, disagree on a purchase budget, considering how different the Japanese mentality is when it comes to saving, investing, and buying higher ticket items like property. So super deep, although a bit meandering conversation there on the topics of education and finances as these relate to real estate. Hope you enjoy the conversation, and I'll see you again on the other side.
I think I'm recording now too. Emil's got all these little robots recording and doing stuff on his behalf.
Yes, that's how it should be.
Soon as we have like physical implants, Emil's going to sign up for all of them, right? He's going to have like antennas coming out of his head and things on his ears. And...
give me all the implants. I think I need to start with hair implants, to be honest.
No.
All right, have you both here. First time for the new year, although we'll probably release it in a couple of months. But how were your holidays?
Quiet.
Right?
Yes. Yes, it was lovely. We didn't go anywhere, you know.
Didn't do anything. It was awesome.
No, home office. I had home office. I did had to visit a few properties, but that was like, you know, just quick here and there. And then just quiet because the kid is studying. So,
yeah.
Yes, it's a trying times in this household.
You guys take it very seriously. I'm not going to comment on that.
He takes it seriously. It's not me. It's okay. The child. It was his choice. He has the school of his choice where he wants to go. And he's very, very motivated.
My son's got a school he wants to go to too, but all he does is sit at home and play the guitar rather than study. So I don't know if the motivation is as high as the wish to go to that school.
I don't know if that's motivation.
Yeah, I don't know. But Emil had a bit more of an exciting holiday than us two, right? I just slept basically too.
Yeah, me three, but we went to Fiji in Australia. So that was our little getaway. Fiji being just a transit stop, but we extended it for 1 week. So that was nice. It rained a lot, but I mean, it's Fiji and it's lovely. Even in the rain, kids are in the pool playing. I think they were underwater more than they were above water for that 1 week. And just see the family. It's nice to get back. But similarly to you, Blanca, we likely will not be going back to Australia again this year because our eldest as well, he's preparing for the Juken test.
But yours for Chugako, right?
Yes. Yeah. So yeah, he's fifth grade now, going into sixth. So he's got to prepare now. So I think like towards the end of this year, 2025, is when his exams are going to be.
We might as well explain to our non-Japan residents. Sorry,
Juken for Chugako is also usually January.
The returnee kids are
okay. He has the return. Oh yes, because he was abroad, so he can use the returnee.
Yeah, that's the expectation. So yeah, November around end of the year. Otherwise, January. So we'll see how it goes.
Can you give a brief outline for our non-resident viewers and listeners about why this is such a big time for parents and kids?
Well, because in Japan, the school year starts in April. So basically, like my son, he is finishing his junior high school by March this year. So last year, November, we had to submit the schools of his choice where he wants to go to high school. And then, you know, depending on what school, how competitive your school is, you have to prepare for it. Because now, for example, for us, January 17 and 18, his school choice number one has the exams.
And you only have one or two shots at this, right?
He has three. They actually pushed him for a third choice. That's why, like, he absolutely has no interest in going there. But they call it Tsuberidome, which is kind of like your backup plan. Cool. You know, that it's basically a school that you know they'll accept you either way, because he chose both of his number one and number two schools are quite competitive. So the school, his junior high pushed him to basically do a third choice just in case it would not work out, you know, whatever. So
And that's similar.
that's where
So
we're at right now.
he.
Otherwise, you know, I don't know what, but you know, I'm not expecting him not to get.
Yeah. Blanca, so he's in middle school, third grade.
Yes.
And so this is to get into high school. For us, we're doing it sort of at his, our son is in middle, sorry, in elementary school now, fifth grade, going up to sixth grade. So we want to do that testing for junior high.
Yes, you
So.
want to do Chugako that has a Koko as well,
Yeah,
so then you would
exactly.
not, so he would not have to do this in 3 years,
Exactly,
basically.
yeah. So we want to do it from middle school, basically in Australia's equivalent of year 7 that goes through to year 12. And there's different thoughts. Some people want to do it like now, earlier in for middle school entrance exams. And so these are basically for like the private high schools. All high schools are private pretty much in Japan. So you have to do an entry exam somewhere along the line. If you jump into it. So it's common to do it in the middle school entrance exam, and then it goes through to high. In your case, it sounds like you went to the public middle school
He
and
did, yes.
now
Yeah, he
high
went to our local
school.
here, 10 minutes from home. I didn't want him to commute for junior high school.
Yeah.
I'm not big on commuting at all. I'm lucky, that's why we are all basically praying for his choice number one, because his school number one is still 15 minutes walk from the house.
You don't want to go too far.
And it's a great school. It has a very high, I think it's Hensachi 67. So it's quite high on the level, and it has a strong English program, and it has a school, like it cooperates with universities abroad. So it already has a program that prepares you for the uni abroad.
Oh, nice. Fantastic.
So yes, it's a good school.
Are you
Yeah, for
feeling that this is a much bigger deal in Asia than it is in other countries? I know in Australia, for example, a lot of people are just like, yeah, I'll go for a tradie school or a TAFE, or you know, I can get a job in many ways. It's not really that crucial to have the best kind of academic progression to the best schools. But in
Well,
Asia, it's
anybody
a
can
big
do
thing.
that. Yeah, I think anybody can do that. They'll do the same thing. But my kid wants to go to a very good school, because my kid, you know, in our family, we kind of like education. We like quality things. We believe that if you have a good education, it lays you a kind of base for. Because he is planning on university abroad, anyways. So because of that, he knows that, okay, now, right now he had, whatever, as he said, like it's a 3 months of hard work, but then he can relax. But it's a stepping stone for his future. So he's kind of like, you know, very focused. He said, you know what, we can have fun, we can travel after I get accepted, we can have a New Year celebration after I get accepted to school, but right now he's not playing around at all. So he takes it seriously. For me, it's a different concept, because in Czech, I got accepted to very, very good high school based on what I've learned in school, in elementary school. Over here, the regular school does not prepare you for the private school exams, so you have to study extra, because the exams for the high school are so different from what they are so advanced to comparing to what they are studying in school, that it will just not prepare you. So that's why he's pre like we are paying extra courses for him to study for that exam. You know, it is what it is.
No, but I guess, okay, sorry, I should rephrase. My question is, do you feel that having a really good diploma from a really good school is still much more significant in Asia than it is? Like, for example, myself, I grew up in the workforce. I grew up in is I was a horrible student, but that's beside the point. But I grew up in the workforce in Israel until I was in my late 20s, and we hired and trained a lot of people. And for us, it was an IT, which has always been a bit of an outlier. But for us, the actual diploma meant very little compared with character and experience and skills that people might have picked up on their own. But here it's still a very, very big thing, isn't it?
Still, here is a big thing, and in Czech, it's in Europe, it's the same thing. They want to see, first of all, for them to even invite you for an interview, you need to first check the boxes, and diploma is one of them. So I still think, having a good quality education is important. So, of course, down the line, if he decides, he wants to take over family business, any of them, he's very welcome to. But he will not be depending on that, right? So he can actually build his own path, whatever he decides to do. I would, even if he is to join the family business down the line, I would actually prefer if he first goes and works somewhere else, to get different experience and the different perspective before he would join the family businesses anyways.
And in many of
So,
those places, he will need to have a significant diploma.
yeah, and then for that he will need a diploma. He will, like, our three daughters, from they all studied here in Japan, but all studied in a good universities, and they got recruited from universities to a very good companies that were, again, stepping stones for them to build their careers. So we kind of like a good education, hoping for
Surprisingly
it at
enough,
least.
to get a real estate license, which is one of the hardest testing methods in Japan, harding testing systems in Japan, doesn't require a university diploma, but the test itself is a bit of a nightmare, isn't it?
So I think, like, just jump back on the education part of it. For us, our goal is, the kids, we want them to go to university in Australia, ideally, not in Japan. Part of it is the critical thinking that I think that maybe Japanese universities are not caught up to yet compared to the West. But also, just international exposure. If you are just very good at Japanese, then you're limited to work only in Japan. Whereas if you can competent in English, you can pretty much work anywhere in the world. So
No, it's just true. Which is
that's one
true.
of the aspects. For us, though, I think a big part of choosing the middle school and high school, it's not we want to go to a great, very academic one, but we want one that is, again, sort of has a bilingual kind of curriculum or
Yes.
is heavy strong in the English.
Yeah.
So it's, and look at, for a lot of families with more, like, more than one kid, often the kids go to different schools, like the middle schools that they enter, different ones. So each one, it's like, which one is the best for my child, right? That they can sort of
Yeah.
flourish in. So it's not whether or not it's a big brand name, like university, for example. It's which one is the best option for my particular
Yeah,
child.
for
And
the kid, for the particular
yeah,
kid,
exactly.
definitely, and that's what David was looking for, like, honestly, having the strong English program, having opportunities abroad, like summer programs abroad, things like that, having strong ties to universities abroad, having a program that helps you prepare for studying abroad, so all that stuff. So he was looking at that. Luckily, his Japanese is perfect, so luckily his native Japanese helped there, so he was able to sift through all those things himself. And so yeah, number one, number two, fingers crossed.
And you've mentioned your preferences for number one because it's, close to home.
It was our preference, to be very honest, it was our preference for Chugako for the middle school as well, for junior high, but he didn't pass the exam, because he only decided, like, 6 months before, maybe even less, before the exam period, that, oh, he's gonna try. And to be honest, he didn't have enough time to prepare, and at that time he did not, I would say he didn't even have the right juku. When he then, at the beginning of Sannense or Ninense, yeah, I think in, like, year two of his junior high, when he discussed where he wants to go for Koko, for high school, they actually told him in that juku that they are not the right ones for him, and that he needs a different juku that will
Juku
prepare
being
him.
after hours school
The
program.
after our school, like, basically after our classes, And they told him like, well, you better go somewhere else. They even told him like, okay, go one of these because they will prepare you. Over here, you're not gonna make it.
Would you consider, I know a lot of Japanese families do that. I'm wondering about you guys. Would you consider actually moving somewhere for a school?
Like meaning abroad or
No, I mean
here?
abroad, obviously, because we're international. But I mean, if let's say one particular school anywhere in Japan or anywhere in Tokyo would be more suitable for your kids, would you consider relocating the family close to it? No.
No.
I do know some Japanese
Listen,
families that do.
I'm
That's why
not
I'm
that
asking.
person. I'm not that person. I would not do it. We do have a small apartment in Tokyo, in Minatoku. So if he gets accept, if he doesn't get his number one and gets into his number two, which is in Minatoku, he has an option to stay in that place on the days that the school is long or the next day the school is early, stuff like that. So he does have an option to stay closer. So he doesn't have to commute every day. But no, I will not move. I have a nice house and it's
No,
mine.
I'm with you.
It's
I'm
not a
actually even
rental
more extreme
property.
than you
I
guys,
think it's
but
different. I think it's different when you're renting. But I mean, listen, I've spent time finding my house here. I'm not going until I'm moving out of Japan. I'm not moving out of this house.
Now, if you've attended any of our recent JREP Summit events in Tokyo or online, you've probably heard our sponsor, Robert Miller from Innovatius.com. He's been in web solutions here in Japan for the past 25 years, and he's also an active investor in Japanese real estate property, as well as global online property, which is his specialty and what his company, Innovatius, is all about. They offer a full suite of website services for entrepreneurs and small business owners, including all aspects of web design and management, backup and updates, content formatting and editing, proactive maintenance and error fixing, you name it. With a strong focus on SEO excellence, which is what gets you those hardcore top of the list search engine rankings. But there is a difference. Innovatius works off a simple, all-inclusive monthly subscription model, as opposed to the typical outdated and confusing project model. So you never have to wonder how much any request for any work to be done on your website might cost. It's always $497 per month. And if that's not enough, if you've mentioned you've heard of their services on the Japan Real Estate Podcast, you'll also get 10% off this monthly price for life. Also, and equally important, if not more, you can try out Innovatius for just 1 month, then switch them off, on again later if you want, and so forth. There are no minimum subscription terms. Now, if you're a small business owner, managing and growing a website is super distracting and time-consuming, right? That's exactly where Innovations comes in. Robert's team takes care of all of that for you so that you can focus on what you do best. So feel free to email Rob on robert@innovatius.com, and his team will conduct a full SEO and website audit on your site, reveal anything that you should address to increase your website's appeal, and provide you with an easy-to-read, detailed report with your own branding so that you can make some informed decisions on your online strategy and watch your business grow as you implement it. So once more, robert@innovatius.com. Drop him a line and get your website reviewed today.
That's another thing actually ties into real estate too, is we have had quite a few tenants in our customers and our clients' properties that where parents are renting an apartment for the child to go to school, and not just uni students, including even junior high, not just high school.
I know that is an option. That's why I'm saying that's why we have the apartment in Minatoku because we don't really use it
Yeah,
but that
but
much anymore because
that's a uniquely Japanese thing, is I don't know any other country where, parents rent out a property for their junior high school kids to
because
live in.
that's not true. When I was on high school, the first year I lived in a dorm, I hated it. So then I was renting a room
Okay,
year
this is in
from
check.
this is in Czech because my high school was far from home, but I hated the dorm. So from high school, it's absolutely normal. Like from the age 15, it's normal to rent a room or apartment depending on where you go for school. If you don't want to stay in the dorm, that's what you do.
So that's I'm the uneducated one. I raised my eyebrows the first time I ran across one of these.
No. That's a normal thing. But high school, because they are 15 already, so it's the better thing to do than have them commute, and literally they would burn out if they have to commute 2 hours every day there and back. They'll burn out. That makes no sense.
So
Mental health.
I find with like, so when I get clients, usually when they choose which family house they want, if the kids are still young and close to like starting elementary school, then that's where the family will, they want to be close to a certain elementary school.
Yeah.
Or if kids are already in one of the elementary schools, they want to go from renting to buying or a bigger place. They want to stay within a
Yes.
distance of that same school, so they don't want to change.
Yeah.
But
Yeah.
yeah, once, like once they get into sort of well, even junior high school, so 12, like 13 years old, then a 1 or 1.5 hour commute is within reason
Yeah,
for
I
those
think
kids.
90 minutes, it's kind of the limit you should, door to door, 90 minutes.
So I think even an hour is sort of the extent of where we're acceptable for us, where
Yeah.
we're not bringing it down to. But yeah, for a lot of families, kids that age, they can commute that 90 minutes. So I don't really see families changing their location where they live just for a junior high school or middle
No.
school because the kid can commute. But I do see them being selective when they have young kids still like in kindergarten, and they're trying to choose which school they go to,
Cool. Yeah. That's
either the
what we
12.
did. That's what we did when we were when we bought our first house, because we used to live in an apartment, and then we bought our first house. We were looking, you beheaded in a specific neighborhood that we liked, and we liked the school, their elementary school. But the house, even though it was a gorgeous house, it was very unpractical. It was like the worst house you can have. Absolutely, like energetically nightmare, because it was all one floor, open floor plan, huge windows, zero insulation. I mean, horrible. Gorgeous, but horrible. And then, so after about 2 years, 2 or 3 years, 3 years, we were like, oh my God, we actually start hating the house and we wanted to move. But my husband's condition was, okay, I'll buy a different house, but it has to be within this neighborhood. So David doesn't have to change school.
So with elementary schools as well, how it works is a little bit different is your elementary school, the public ones in Japan, they're based on where you live. So you
Yeah.
are, because of which area you're in that catchment, you're guaranteed to go to that school. You're guaranteed a placement. So by seeing which particular local elementary schools you want your child to go to, then just by buying a property there or renting there, you have access to that school. That runs, for 6 years, or if you have 2 or 3 kids, it might be a full a decade. So
Yeah.
it's quite a significant decision based on the elementary school, especially in the Azabu area in Minatoku, right? You have quite a few of the very popular
Yeah.
elementary schools that have a lot of English support. Like over 10, 20% of the kids will be mixed or foreign.
Yeah.
So they have even the materials that they send back home, there's an English version of it too. And even though they're
Which
public.
would have been very, very helpful.
I would have loved to have that here.
So some people like choose because of that, but for elementary school, that's very significant. But and you have all your kids go to that public one, right? And in education, public education is free, so there's lots of value there
Great.
as well. But
Yeah.
then when it comes to middle school and high school, one, maybe each of your kid goes to a different one. Two, you can't guarantee which one they're going to go to until like 2 to 3 months before school starts. Like in your case, Blanca, your test is in January
Yeah.
and entries in April. So he doesn't know
April.
if he's going to A, B, or C until like February, right?
No, he will like, and that's another great thing about the school number one is he does the test 17, 18, and on the 19th we know if he got accepted or not.
Okay,
Oh, wow.
yeah, but that's 3 months, right? Because
And
it's
but yeah, it is 3 months before, it's
3 months.
actually 2.5 months before he has to start somewhere.
Yeah,
It's like
so
10 weeks before.
so it's very hard to try to decide which house to buy based on
Yes.
which high school you want to go
Might
to.
go to, yeah.
You
Yeah.
don't know until 2, 3 months beforehand.
You would not be able to do that, no.
Yeah, so I find people will move for elementary schools, but not for middle school or high school because once.
I also think, and this is a horrible thing to say, but I don't think Japanese care that much when it comes to commuting. For them, is that like, shogunai, well, that's what it is. If you have to commute, you have to commute.
Yeah, the
Suck it
hour and
up,
a
you.
half you mentioned earlier was mind-blowing for me. I can't see, like, now he's walking 20 minutes to school and he's complaining all the way.
That's why I'm praying. Like, his number two choice is door to door, 1 hour 10 or 1 hour 15 minutes, door to door. And he's willing to do that if need be because it's a great school. But doing it on daily basis,
Yeah, we had a list.
I think he would change his mind. So that's why I told him, I said, you better work hard to get to Senmatsu because, that one's 10, 15 minutes walk from here.
Yeah, we did like we basically had the list of all the schools that we think are suitable, and then just on Google Maps, door to door, how long, and we just cut it down to 60 minutes. We got down to like six schools, and then of those six, we did okay, what are the top three? That we really want to focus on.
Do you
And we
find that it's the same with university students? Are they willing to travel a long distance door to door to go to their campus?
or a lot of university students, they already then stay, in dorms or rent apartments.
or rent
Universities
apartments
are,
close to it. Yeah.
different. Around the universities, you will always have a lot of long-term apartments, one bedroom apartments that are rented to students.
Yep.
That's one of the things that we were looking at some very, very cheap properties in an area that, okay, Japanese don't really want to live there, but it's popular for students because it's very close to university. But you cannot license, like it cannot be minpaku, so you are literally relying on students and things like that. And they
But
were relatively cheap because then you kind of, if you buy, or they were like, one of them was a house that was very narrow but had three or four different rooms, so you can have a, three students living there that, go to that university. So that's one of the popular, semi-popular, when it comes to buying investment properties, that you'll buy
A
it
lot of
in a
people ask us
proximity.
about, yeah,
You buy
student
it in a
housing, they call
proximity
it
of
overseas.
university
Yeah,
and
definitely.
then, attract the students.
Yeah. I have, even for investors, right, Ziv, you'd be experienced with this, but like homeowners, like with the ones that are looking, even sometimes we get couples that don't have kids. They've got no plans for kids, but they consider in the future, maybe there'll be some resale or renting it out if they leave Japan. So being close to elementary schools is really, really, useful. Close to shops, close to schools, close to parks.
That's always in Japan, right?
Although, I mean,
But
that's
for
in every country.
family sized
Yeah.
properties, if you're talking studios or one bedrooms, not so much.
Yeah. But usually, when people are buying for their own, their own family home, like in my case, or again, a couple with no kids, or if they do have kids, being close to the school is always a good selling point. Even if they're not going to use that school in the future, any other typical Japanese family would likely go to the local elementary school.
It makes it easier to resell.
Yeah. Or even rent. And what's good with the rentals, if you do that, is if a family moves in and they've got a young kid, they're in there for the 6 years.
Yes,
They're not moving.
that was when we were looking for people to rent the newest house that we have here behind our house. It was like we literally had a condition like we do not want single person.
Those jump and change once they got
Yes, exactly, because
to.
there's like, so that like one of like preference families with
Yeah.
young children, because you catch them, you have that for years because they would not want to move.
Well, with university students, it's a bit, I mean, it depends on the campus. If it's a medical campus, for example, then yes, they'll be there for at least 4 or 5 years. But a lot of the other campuses, it's not that. Not bad, but they do
Even
tend to
three
change.
years, it's not even 3 years, it's not bad when because when you're buying that kind of property that you'll be renting to students, that's where you're going. That's what you're planning on,
Correct. Yeah.
right? So that's always, I just had a call with a client and he already bought the property and basically we were discussing the plans. And I told him, like, you need to decide who is your clientele. What is your target audience? And that's like, you know, whatever you do in terms of, you know, investments and it's with properties and it's with any, like, if you do marketing, you always need to know your audience. And that's the same thing when you're buying real estate for investment purposes. You need to know who's your target, who is your clientele. Tracy would tell you the same thing. You need to know who you are renting to, and then depending on that, you know, you furnish it. You know, like for us, we were talking about, you know, the finishings and everything. You need to know who you're renting to, and then depending on that, you know, you either buy a very cheap toilet or you buy a beautiful, you
That's
know,
very true. We actually have a property manager here that every time the property becomes vacant, he gives us two or three renovation plans. And he says, you know, if you spend 1,000, $2,000, we'll be able to quickly get a Southeast Asian, you know, convenience store worker or factory worker or student in there. If you go up to this level, we can get you an entry level salary man. If you go up to this level, it's actually a thing.
And that's what it is. So, you know, and that's the same thing with properties here in Tokyo. You need to know wherever you are getting investment property, you need to know who you're going to be renting to. And then based on that, so if you are renting to students 2, 3 years, that's still good. You know.
The building itself plays a part too. I mean, as beautiful as you make the interior, if the building looks like crap, a lot of people will not be renting there, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, or listen, we have a great apartment, but it's in an old mansion that has still the low ceilings, right? So no matter what, and I renovated it before the last tenant went in, and so like purposely put lighter floorings and, you know, like everything lighter, so it makes it looks, you know, more bit like bigger and everything, but still you're still dealing with that Japanese building, so you know that a specific clientele will not be happy there because, you know, already the ceiling is too low for them and stuff like that. And then, you know, what are you gonna do?
I took one client to look at this property. He's an executive, he and his family. It was about 300 million, 350 million yen. So it's like $2.5 million US. It's a beautiful apartment, about 180 square meters, with the rooftop terraces it had on the top. So it was apartment, the top, entire top floor. So all around just the rooftop terraces came to about 100 square meters of
Gorgeous.
space, right? Near Utenji. And it was fantastic, but they go, they just the entrance to the building, that the building was a little bit old. And I mean, this was like buildings maybe 90s or early 2000s. So not the 80s or 70s. Still looks, you know, okay. Because yeah, just the facade and stuff. If I bring other executives, you know, over for dinner or whatnot, it was a bit embarrassing. You know, even though it's a 300 million, you know, $2.5 million property.
But still, the entrance, you know, those things matter a lot.
And the
So,
neighborhood, right? Yeah, obviously the neighborhood.
I mean, that was like Utenji, so the neighborhood's fantastic. But yeah, just the building itself, just the age of the entrance and the lobby, the facade of it was a bit, you know, untreated
No.
for a few years. So you definitely get that. And when you have that kind of budget, yeah, definitely there's, it's strange when the very budget conscious, like, you know, under, you know, half a million or $1 million, looking at apartments, you tend to be more just the size and square meterage. But when you go to the more premium sort of properties, it's like every aspect of the building.
Everything matters.
Yeah, it's a
Everything
concierge there
matters.
every day. We don't want some. We want someone to take care of everything for us. When we
But
enter
you
the
know what? When you're already spending that much money on a property, then you want everything to be perfect because, you know, you're not going to move in, you know, next month or whatever. You don't want to be compromising on things when you're spending it. It has to be perfect. You know, when you
Definitely.
are buying under 1 million or around half a million, you do have to compromise one way or another. So it's
Yeah, I love
different.
how you say the budget-oriented people under half a million. You should talk to some of my customers, man.
Listen, I am dealing with somebody similar that it's very budget oriented when it comes to renovations, and it's not easy.
No.
And I mean, you know what? Like, we'll see. We have a final meeting tomorrow. We'll see if we agree on things or not. But, you know, at the end of the day, they bought what they bought, and they have a lot of properties. And before they're going to rent it out, somebody left the properties, and then after they left, they need to renovate it before they can put it back on the market. And I'm like, but this is a dump, right? So you do have to invest in it if you want to, actually rent it out and stuff. And they go like, yeah, but we don't really want to put too much in it because it's old.
Because it's a dump.
And because but because even the building already, like, yeah, one of them is close to you, Emil. If we're gonna renovate it, I'll be coming over for coffee.
Oh,
I'll
no.
be there on regular basis.
Yeah, but again, I mean, different types of properties, different types of renovations appeal to different
Exactly.
types of tenants. I mean, there
So
are slumlords out there,
I
so
told them you have to decide. So don't you have to renovate it, but re let's renovate it with a cheaper materials. Because you know how much you are getting rent for it, so but you do need to invest accordingly. And that their third property is like, oh, that's where we want our management to stay. I'm like, well, then you better splurge a little bit if your management will be staying. So
We interrupt this broadcast to tell you about Tokyo Family Stays. They're a short-term rentals company in Tokyo, and they offer a home away from home experience, which is just perfect for remote working, quarantining, if that's still a thing, or if you just need somewhere quiet to get away from the world. They offer a variety of options for families, corporate relocations, or even if you're simply transitioning between homes in Tokyo. The properties are super comfortable, tastefully furnished, fully equipped with all amenities, and they accommodate up to 10 people. So, really, the only thing you'll need to bring with you is your toothbrush and maybe a change of clothes. They come with fast, unlimited wireless internet, dedicated workspaces, and fully equipped kitchens, and they're just a delight to stay in. Fantastic alternative to Japanese business hotels, which, if you've ever stayed in one, you probably know they're tiny, they're noisy. Fine for a night or two if you're on your own, but longer term or with a family, you'll probably feel you're in a jail cell very quickly in a Japanese business hotel. So if you want to give yourself a sense of space and freedom by renting a real home with comfortable Western beds, including all the necessities like baby bedding, children's toys, high chairs, etc., you definitely want to reach out to Tokyo Family Stays. They've been at it for over a decade. They're a fully licensed minpaku or short-term stay operator. And as a special bonus for our viewers and listeners, they're also throwing in a breakfast basket upon arrival for anyone who books and mentions the Japan Real Estate Podcast or NTI. And not only for guests, if you're a property owner, you've got an investment property that you want to tweak for higher profit, or a holiday home that you want to rent out when you're not using it via short-term stays, drop them a line today. See how they can help you maximize your property's income. And again, as a special bonus to our viewers and listeners, they're also offering a free audit of your existing short-term stay listings without any obligation whatsoever. So feel free to reach out to them at tokyofamilystays.com. Well worth a visit. And again, if you're in the market for a family home in or around the Tokyo metropolitan area, Emil's your man. Don't be shy to reach out to him as well at sales@realestate.jp. And now, back to the podcast.
We had a couple we were showing. We did some properties around Tokyo Dome, and they're about 300, 320 million yen. It's about 2 million US. They're looking, and they're just a couple and just looking for a holiday house, like 3 to 6 months a year to come and to use. And one option that they saw was like 180 million yen. And I'm like, oh, 180 million, let's check on the calculator, like the exchange rate. That's about 1.2, 1.3 mil US. So they kept referring to that as the budget option. You can go all out or do the budget option. But I find even with people that are sort of, a few hundred thousand dollars, like under a million, or the people that are in the 3 million, 300 million yen price range, they are still conscious of price, but the scale is slightly different,
Very
right?
true.
They do see, oh, like that budget is like 300 million, that's it, which is like 2 million US, that's it. And pushing over, they really think about, is that good use of their money beyond that, right? So they're still quite conscious, but instead of being, 5,000 yen, or 10,000, a few hundred thousand yen difference or a few million yen difference, it's 10, 20, 30 million yen difference that their scale of what's above budget or this is their cap.
But that's
Same
how it
with
is in
everything.
life, right? When you start earning, and you earn, let's say, $1,000. You can still budget your lifestyle according to that $1,000. And as you grow, your salary grows or your income grows, but also your lifestyle expenses grow. And then your budget is up to that 10,000 or 100,000.
Exactly the same.
That's how it is.
I feel that the most when I'm traveling. I remember in my backpacker days, it was, do I take the bus or do I take the flight? And now it's, do I take the short flight or do I take the very convenient? Like it upgrades with the years.
Exactly. So you always live up, you always live with some budget in mind. And it doesn't matter if it's 1,000 or 1,000,000, but in a way, there is always some sort of a budget.
If you're the fortunate kind of person who had that kind of education, we're actually, this is a good chance to talk about that. We're doing our, every year we used to give out gifts, send out like a pen set or a calendar or stuff to customers. But a few years ago, we started just donating to a charity, like a rotating charity every year on their behalf. And they like that. So every year we alternate. And this year's charity is going to be exactly that, like financial education. Like there are so many
Are you
people in the world.
sponsoring my project? Are you sponsoring my NPO?
Jumpstart, it's called. No, is that you? It's pretty big, I think.
No, Jumpstart is not us.
No, sorry.
I'm going to solicit you guys for donations very
Oh,
soon. Don't
please
worry.
do. Yeah, we do that every at
We
the
do
end of every year.
financial education for children.
But
So.
there are the point being, there are people who actually grow up and as soon as they get a hike in salary, it all goes out for
Yeah,
nonsense, right? Like there's
budgeting,
no
budgeting.
budgeting involved whatsoever.
People don't know how to budget, and that is the biggest problem, and I think, and for example, I see it with renovations that people can't really visualize the cost of some of things, or they don't understand that there is always additional cost. And I don't know how, Emil, you have it. Probably, okay, so you people see, okay, the property is 100 million, but then there are fees that are going to come with that and stuff like that. And people think like, oh, if it's 100 million, it's 100 million, and that's what's going to cost me. And or they bought something. The worst is like, oh, I've done similar property 5 years ago. It was a little bit smaller, but blah, 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 5 years ago, and it cost me 7 million. So is this going to be 7, 8 as well? I'm like, no. First of all, prices 5 years ago and now completely
I had one
different.
customer whose budget was so tight by the end of the purchase, he didn't even have enough money for insurance for the next 2, 3 years.
Oh my God. So that is, you see, so that's the problem. People don't understand that budgeting, it's not just the actual cost. There's a lot of things that have to be calculated for. And because, but that's because people, to be very honest, don't understand the budget for their own life.
Yeah, that's exactly
They cannot
financial education.
manage.
That's exactly the point. Yeah. What's
This is
that? What's that, Emil?
a book. It's an Aussie author. So I can't put that on my background and blur it. It's called The Barefoot Investor. It's this guy here. This is one for families. So it's basically your parents read it, and it's how to teach money management to your kids at an early age. So, with their allowance or their savings, their funds, whatever, they have three different
My
buckets, like
son
estate,
hates us
pension.
so much because of exactly that.
Yeah,
From
that.
day one, we're like, this is the allowance, and this one you need to pay for, so you better save from your allowance.
No, David has the same thing. Like even with the money he makes, because he makes money from modeling, he actually has to put 50% into savings, and then has to always come up like with some investment plan. What he's gonna do with that? Where it's gonna go? So at times there's like a lot of unhappy words when he has to, give me half of his.
Well, for us, the big one is tax. So whenever my kids have an ice cream, I teach them about tax. So give me 40%. Oh, that's a tax. Everything you get is giving you losing 40%, kid. They don't like
Oh my God, that's brutal.
that. Yeah,
That's
but so for us,
brutal.
this and actually just this is one that the parents read about how to teach money management to your kids. But there's also the Barefoot Investor for kids, and that's it. One that I just bought last week when I was in Australia.
Nice.
And that's for the kids to read themselves. And they read about other kids, how they make money. It's a bit of a story that they read along, and they do. They also, they make some money. They do some more chores around the house, try to acquire money, then put it into the different buckets, the save, spend, give. stuff. So, yeah, we've been playing with that. And again, I don't know there's one right way, and it's also hard to keep consistent in a household as a parent. It's consistency is very challenging. But I think instilling these at an early age, just understanding of these concepts, quite important. You know, we were saying before about, different clients and how they react and their budgeting. What I find a lot of my clients looking in Tokyo, we say, this is how much the bank will give you, this is how much it will cost, and all the closing costs and stuff. So they know very clearly up front. And a lot of them that are successful are like, okay, great, we're happy with that, or we're very clear this is how much we want to spend. That's it. The ones that I feel end up struggling and then just backing out completely and they don't end up purchasing are where often the husband and wife don't have a clear agreement on the household expenses. More often than not, it's the Japanese side, which usually it's the wife. I used to think it was mostly the wife, but it's actually the Japanese side, even if it's a Japanese husband, right? Most of my clients tend to be foreign husband with a Japanese wife. But it tends to be the Japanese side is quite debt averse. They don't want to borrow too much. They want to keep it as low as possible.
Nonsense.
And when they do their forecasting, they'll say, oh, one side will go and say, I spoke to my a planner, or I did something online and I budget, okay, we need 15,000 yen every month for new clothes for the kids. This much for schooling, this much for travel every year, this much for this. So they budget all these costs and expenses for lifestyle, and they're very conservative, like high estimate on those. And then for just general employment, let's say they're in their 30s, for their regular employment, they think, well, what happens if I lose my job a few times? What happens if there are months without pay? What happens if my salary never increases? So it's always the worst case scenario for the employment situation and the extreme case scenario for the life expenses. And there's such a, you're choosing the worst case of both. So what they end up looking at is a property that's really not realistic for what someone in their income bracket should be looking at. And they go, look, we can't find anything that really appeals to us in this price range. Yeah, because your forecasting is pretty much the extreme example of the worst case scenario, and you're trying to find something in that position.
I suppose that's why they don't really invest that much, right? Like just stick your money in a savings account is unfortunately still the Japanese invest. I can't even call it that, but they just save their money without doing anything because of the risk factor, right?
Right, that they so it's kind of like often what happens is it's indecision. They think that's going to be the extreme example. They can't find what they want, so it's, well, we'll just wait and figure it out later. And they just stay and stay, and they just don't end up buying at all. And they're not happy with renting. They still want to buy, but they don't both agree to it. They disagree. Like the Japanese side wants to be very conservative with the assessment. The foreign side is like, no, that's too extreme. But because there's disagreement, nothing progresses. And people's, when I sell homes, I'm kind of like a fly in the wall on seeing a healthy relationship, just how a healthy relationship looks like. And I learn a lot, and now I reflect with my relationship, the communication that and the acceptance that they have with each other when we look at different properties. Sometimes, spouse like, yeah, no, I don't like this because of this. And even if the other spouse loves the house, like, oh, okay, sure, I understand that, and they leave it at that, and that's it. It's just very healthy and clear communication. But the ones that don't have a healthy version of that, they're just not successful and even achieve in buying a property. It ends up we do a handful of viewings, and then yeah, no, it just they're off the radar. It's
Which is a shame because the amount of rent that they're paying is way more than they might have lost on any kind of wrong loan, right?
Now, here's some big news for anyone interested in Akiya, the abandoned vacant homes that are abundant all around Japan for very attractive purchase prices. Akiya Mart, our latest sponsor, is a recently founded online search and discovery tool for Japanese real estate. Its user interface will be very familiar to users of Zillow or Redfin. The platform essentially scouts the internet for property listings, translates them into English, and displays prices in US dollars, all in one place and with a dynamic map interface that makes browsing, finding, and shortlisting your favorite properties a piece of cake. Which any of you have been struggling with the dozens, if not hundreds, of Japanese property websites that are available online and their very clunky interface will probably find a real blessing. They've got already over 500,000 listings on the platform, and the database is expanding daily, ranging from abandoned rural homes to luxury urban properties. AkiyaMart makes it easy to find your dream home in Japan, regardless of your budget. Now, while the platform is essentially free for use, here's an exclusive offer for listeners of the podcast. You can use the promo code NTI to receive $5 off AkiyaMart Pro. The subscription will unlock a bunch of very attractive features for you, including unrestricted access to the entire nationwide property database and a whole range of filters, which will help power charge your search for that elusive perfect home and make it even easier. So hop over to akiya-mart.com. That's AKIYA-MART, akiya-mart.com, and kick off your search today.
I have the same thing with renovations. I was dealing with a couple, and they basically, and it was the husband's business. It was not even family home. It was the husband's business. And the husband chose something, but then he had to travel. And he told the wife, well, then talk to Blanca and you guys figure it out. And the wife started completely changing everything the husband chose. To the point that I told her, I said, you know what, well, you guys better sit down and talk, because what you just told me is something completely different than what your husband told me. And I've prepared everything, we were literally before signing the contract, and I prepared everything, you know, regards to that, and I spent a lot of time also preparing that, because it's not, and now you're telling me something completely different. So maybe you guys should talk, and then when you cleared your, like, you agreed on some vision, then get back to me, because I cannot be like, he tells me this, she tells me that, it's completely different. I can't work with two visions that are so different. It just doesn't work that way. And then so it just kind of, you know, went away, and I'm not even reaching out, because I'm like, you know, clearly
the other extreme end of that is we've had quite a few couples that have contacted us, couldn't reach an agreement, and then one of them contacts us a couple of years later, say, okay, we're divorced now, so we're going for this. That happens too.
Oh my god, yes. Well, that's the other extreme.
I had one guy, he's buying a holiday house here, and he's looking at it's like his dream for many years. He did exchange year when he was in school as an American guy, and he's buying a property here, and quite a high budget, and he asked his wife, and he's showing her that I did the virtual walkthrough and recording, I sent it to him, and he tries to show his wife, and his wife's like, look, it's your dream, just do whatever you like, don't involve me in it. And she's just full freedom. It's like, so that's the other one where, okay,
I gotta say, I'm a bit of that too, like when we go shopping for investment properties or for the next home, I'm like, yeah, I like it, but you know, if you prefer that one, that's okay, I can live anywhere, I'm good, I don't mind. Yeah. There's money in the bank every month, that's all right, good enough.
Yes, yes.
I'm sorry, that's... I'll have to cut it short on this happy note.
No worries, yes, I'm actually
divorces and shit, but sorry.
Going for a meeting as well.
Happy 2025 to you guys,
yes,
but also
guys,
to all of our viewers and listeners. Hope you all had a restful holiday season, and go get them.
Big plans for 2025.
Yes, yep. We have a big plans. We are planning our
We can announce.
Spring.
That's right. We can announce.
We are planning
12-13 April. Yes. 12-13 April. If you need to get your flight tickets, this is the date. We're not sure about the venue exactly yet, but it is going to be in Tokyo. It is going to be similarly priced to previous years. So you can assume something like under 10,000 for a single day and under 20,000 for both days. And the conference keeps growing. The Japan Real Estate Summit is a real thing now. More and more speakers, more and more content, more and more breakout rooms. And a lot of people who keep coming back. So we hope to see you among us as well, live or via the streaming.
Thank you so much.
All right. Okay. Talk to you soon. Thank you.
Talk to you soon, guys. Bye.
Bye-bye.
So there you have it. Hope you've enjoyed the conversation as much as Blanca, Emil, and I did. And if you want to have a chat with us, as well as with all of the other amazing speakers this weekend, Anton Warman, Matt Ketchum, Tracy Northcott, Chai Kanda, Alicia Kinwang, Hidoshi Shimizu, Matthew Kyle, Shumatsu Post, and Brett Lee, this is the last reminder you'll get from us here on the podcast. Tickets are only available until this coming Friday, 11 April, for this weekend's Japan Real Estate Summit event, the biggest and best English language real estate industry event here in Japan, with the best collection of professionals, experts, and like-minded folks like yourselves. Hope to see you all there with us, in person or online via the streaming Zoom room, where you'll also be able to chat and network with each other and float questions to be answered live by the speakers on the stage. So if you can't be here in person, the streaming tickets are the next best thing. See you all very, very soon. Now, before we go, we're also, as always, going to tell you and also link to our other sponsor's website. That's Hidoshi Shimizu, immigration lawyer and administrative scrivener. If you're thinking about moving here on a more permanent basis, or you're already in Japan on some sort of a temporary visa and you want to switch to a longer term or permanent one, or if you're considering setting up a local company or a branch office of a foreign company and you've got any sort of business or visa-related inquiries, or even if you just want to find out what your options are on any of these topics, feel free to contact Hidoshi Shimizu. You can find him at japanimmigrationexperts.com. And he can help you set up a company, apply for any kind of visa, or just provide you with the best advice and extremely affordable consultation related to these topics. And he's already done that for many of our listeners. So feel free to reach out to him. Again, that's japanimmigrationexperts.com, and you'll be well on your way. And that's it from us for today, folks. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. Do share it with your networks, and please let us know what you think. So leave us a short rating or review on the iTunes Store, on Spotify, or just drop us a line in the comment section of wherever you might have found this episode. We love hearing from you. Hope to have you with us again next time, and until then, have a great day or night ahead. Yoroshiku.